Just the background to the book a little bit. You know, in one way, 10 years, more than 10 years to some of the start of the crisis looks like historical perspective.
Mm.
In other ways, it feels like current affairs
mm-hmm.
still.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that perspective has allowed you to see through, you know, through the book on the origins of the crash and how it played out?
I think of it more as a it's a quite a tricky question, obviously, because most historians would say you need more time. And what is it that they expect to get through time, through having more distance, would be my response.
Yeah,
what is it
yeah.
they expect to get?
Yeah.
And I think what they expect is some sort of stability. But of course, more often than not, what it simply means is a stable vantage point with a given set of biases, right?
Right.
We now know that witchcraft trials were terrible, and there's
yeah.
really not a whole lot that's going to shift in the next 100 years that's right. going to convince us that witchcraft trials were great.
Yeah.
But we do bring the bias that witchcraft trials are terrible and witches are innocent and they're not, right? But there's a huge bias that's
yeah.
built in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's actually quite problematic, not that I have any question about witches, but it's a massive bias that
yeah.
comes in. Whereas working on something as recent in time as this is you can almost track your bias shifting as you go along.
Right.
So yeah. it's in fact more revelatory, in a sense, of what your biases are. Thanks so much. Precisely because it's...
Shall I come back in an hour?
If we've got that much
yeah,
time, and if Adam's
yeah.
not bored with me,
no,
then
no.
yeah, but that would be great.
No,
yeah. All right, thanks very much.
See, if you like, you can... What I found extraordinary about writing it and is precisely that experience of seeing my preconceptions and seeing my framing of the question constantly under pressure as I was going along.
Right, right.
And the effect of that is to make you more, not less, conscious of this problem that all history has, namely it's framed by your preconceptions.
Yes,
and precisely because
yeah.
it's so immediate. I started writing the book in 2013,
yeah.
basically on the premise that this was a done deal. We had closure, which is why I could write the history.
You talk about it in 2012.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. In 12, there's this deal.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
you know, obviously it's a mixed blessing, cold comfort, you know, it's not as though it's a happy story. But in any case, Obama's re-elected, whatever it takes has fixed the Eurozone. You know, it feels like we had closure. And
mm-hmm.
and so I started writing from the, you know, the conviction that the story that needed to be told was the story of another successful effort of transatlantic's financial stabilization, of which there have been several in the past. And
yeah.
this one was somehow under the radar. People were not talking about the relationship between Europe and America. And this needed to be lifted. And if it wasn't a triumphalist story, it was at least to tell the Americans and the Europeans they were still dependent on each other.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Obama administration and indeed its predecessors had made a crucial set of moves in 2008-09 to stabilize the global banking system. So it was a blow against European complacency, and
yeah.
it was a message to the Americans, wake up, smell coffee, you still have this huge global role that you enact. And then, of course, everything kept shifting on
mm-hmm.
me. So that initial, not complacent or triumphalist, but nevertheless sort of confirming narrative has just been moved again and again and again in the years since,
mm.
with Ukraine, with Greece, you know, round umpteenth round of the Greek crisis, with, of course, with Brexit, with Trump, and with the Chinese near miss crisis of 15-16, the parameters have kept shifting on me. And that's been, you know, I've never written a book where I've been more clear about the way in which my own investments were written into the book and then were shaken by subsequent events. Does that make... I think it gives me, in some sense, at least much more awareness
right,
of,
yeah,
of how I'm of the process and how entangled you are.
Yeah. And in the practical terms of writing the book, what did that mean for you? Did you have to revise
yeah.
parts, or did
yeah.
you have to?
No. I mean, I was writing the book. I didn't finish the manuscript. Didn't really go in until the fall of late October 2017, and then
yeah.
in the copy edits I had to incorporate the, you know, this epic Republican tax giveaway of
yeah.
December 2017, because I'd first written a version of Trump fiscal policy where there wasn't one, and he, you know, the Republicans couldn't get anything done
yeah.
legislatively, and then of course they did, and they got the crucial thing done, which is what their interest groups really want, which
yeah.
is this big tax write-off. So no, it required, and still today, you know, the winds have gone in my direction, as we were saying earlier on. Like, we haven't had certain crises which would have essentially made the book totally irrelevant if we were in a North Korean standoff. Who would want to know about the financial crisis?
Yeah.
But certainly, say, for the eruption of the crisis in Turkey has made me go back to earlier drafts, which were written in 16 when the coup had just happened and the refugee crisis was the top issue. And I thought we needed a Turkey, Middle East, Arab Spring element to this story. And now I'm kicking myself that I took it out. But I probably wouldn't have finished the book in time for 18 if I'd left it in. So, it's a moving carpet. It's,
sure.
Which is, I think, the reality of history, except you experience it in a super concentrated, speeded up form if you're writing about something as recent as this.
Yeah. You write early on that you took a chilly approach to look at the book. I mean that's just presumably the sort of discipline you needed to bring it all together, was it?
And also because of the stuff I'm dealing with. One of the reviewers rather unkindly referred to it as bloodless. I thought it was a great review. It was a very telling comment at the end, and I've been thinking about it a lot since because it's such a kind of cutting and telling remark. Obviously, I would prefer cold-blooded to bloodless, and it certainly is cold-blooded. And I was very conscious of writing that book, and I say so in the introduction because I was also conscious of the bias of the materials that I'm using. It's a book written from the elite perspective. It's about the failures of an elite project of economic governance. No apologies for writing that book, but that's what it is. This is not a bottom up. This is not an experiential book. It's not a book filled with the lives of quote-unquote ordinary people. It's not as though that's absent from the narrative, but that isn't the central purpose of this project.
Yeah.
It's a book about elite political failure. So it's politics and not Marxist. I mean, the guy compares me to E.P. Thompson, Eric Hobsbawm, and C. Wright Mills, and this is a Keynesian book, not a Marxist book. It's a book about... about how structured inequality and the governance that's built around that fails. It's not the book which necessarily discusses the parameters of transformative politics. I mean, if I was interested in that, would be a different matter. But I am demarcating and describing what I take to have been the range of debate that was central. And I do go into at length the Syriza experiment, Varoufakis as finance minister.
Yeah.
So that strikes me as a very interesting moment, and as close as we came to any kind of real radical resistance from within the system. Portugal strikes me as a very interesting experiment, but I felt I'd taxed the reader's patience on the Eurozone as far as I could go. But Portugal in the end has turned out to be in some sense, a much more promising example of what a very intelligent, compromising, progressive politics can do. And I do think there's a lot to be learned there about how strategies... Not of compliance, but also not of direct confrontation, may offer progressive politics more wiggle room. I think this is a theme of the book, that politics is crucial at every stage. Capital markets and business exercise huge and asymmetric power. They're vastly more powerful than other actors in the system, but their power is not absolute. And at a moment of crisis, they're in a position of extreme weakness, in fact.
Yeah.
And the question is what use you make of that moment of weakness and where you can apply leverage. And the idea, for instance, that bond vigilantes are a permanent threat that stalk the world and will haunt any democratic progressive politics, that's nonsense. That's something that conservative politicians invoke to explain why they have to do conservative things, like Osborne did in 2010. We have to do this, otherwise we'll end up like Greece. And it's a reality imposed on countries like Greece by conservative governments in the rest of Europe that don't want to do what's necessary to stabilise bond markets, which would protect Greece, because they don't want Greece protected, because it's a left-wing truant government that they want to discipline. And there's a certain sort of Marxist, frankly, who has a stake in arguing about certain sorts of determinism and the conflicts those necessarily, inevitably and always produce that make democracy under capitalist conditions impossible, that also has a stake in making this case. And Greece provides you with all the evidence you need for that kind of argument, as Argentina does at various moments.
Right.
But the Eurozone, it turns out even the UK, for crying out loud, if you've got an active central bank and a deep bond market for your government debt, you can get away with murder and nothing happens.
Yeah, yeah.
All you need is the confidence your central bank will ultimately act as a buyer of last resort for your government debt. And the UK can have the largest increase in public debt since World War II. And all that happens is sterling devalues, which is not bad for exports. And that's the sum total of the crisis. Interest rates go down.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if you know, the bond market was exerting insuperable pressure on all democratic systems in 2008 and after, you'd expect interest rates to go up. And in Greece they do, in Portugal they do, in Ireland, in Italy they do. But in Germany's never been able to borrow at cheaper rates, right? Mm-hmm. People will pay Germany to lend it money.
Going into negative interest.
Yeah, so German democracy is under zero, nada, absolutely zip, zero pressure. Yeah. It could do whatever it liked at this point.
Yeah.
And as long as the, well, of course, with the Eurozone, you've built this structure. But since Draghi's been in the market, that's the great lesson of 2015. Syriza can happen. You can take the Eurozone to the edge of losing one of its members, and there is not a tremor in the rest of the bond market because the ECB is just hoovering it all up.
Because of the QE.
Yeah, it's all about politics. Yeah, it's all about the interactions between state authorities of different types and their positions in the global system of power, and the Eurozone, the Bank of England, the Swiss National Bank are easily powerful enough and stable enough in that global system to pursue quite autonomous economic policy if they do it intelligently with real determination. But if you've got a Mervyn King pulling the rug from underneath Gordon Brown, you're in trouble.
Yeah,
no, if the Bank of England is going to say to the markets, you know what, we really think we need a fiscal tightening, that is really damaging.
On the couple of days after he's done out.
Exactly. So it's really, you know, that is an explicit conservative elite project against an elected government. We have to be frank about it. And on the other hand, for instance, during the referendum in Italy in 2016, when there was the constitutional referendum and Renzi's mandate was on the line, Draghi explicitly said, I will buy bonds, I will buy Italian bonds, whatever the outcome of this referendum.
Yeah.
And that is a model, I think, of what a central bank ought to do. We ought to have a period either side of all elections when the central bank simply says, we will stabilise the market, and what's more, we will punish speculators because they are acting against the interests of democracy.
That's
and we will hurt them indifferently to the outcome, conservative or progressive.
Yeah.
We will burn anyone who attempts to speculate on this election. So you just assume status quo or else. And we will go after you.
That's interesting.
You know, in the same way as many countries ban opinion polls, and you're not allowed to do polling, markets should not allow to experience, we should deploy the resources of central banks to stabilise markets around elections.
Would you choose other events then as well?
Elections seem to be the critical, the neuralgic one. But yes, I mean, with the swap lines now, with the referendum, in the Brexit referendum, the Bank of England and the Fed turned the swap lines on to stabilise Britain's bank funding, whatever happened in the referendum.
Yeah.
That's the right thing to do, in my view. I obviously hate the referendum outcome,
but
if you're going to have a referendum, you're going to treat it seriously as a democratic exercise, then central bank resources ought to be deployed to support that. And we can't simply assume that nature will protect democracy. It won't, because we're in a privately owned economy that's profit-driven, and so there is an antagonism here. But we do have the resources necessary to minimise that antagonism.
Right.
Not in perpetuity, because obviously if you've got an absolutely radical left government and you did the central bank thing, then as soon as you switched it off, there'd be chaos out the other side. But that's then a question of managing it, right?
Yeah.
You'd manage the transition, you'd swap the central bank governor out, and you'd go on batting for some time afterwards. This is not beyond the wit of intelligent politics to use these resources.
Yeah. We'll come back to swap lines in a bit, if that's all right. Just come back to putting the book together. You say it was, it's a book about elites and so on. Yeah. What sort of response did you get when trying to talk to people from the books?
I spoke to... We'll see. The most alarming thing I've had so far, it wasn't alarming, it was very cool actually, is that Peter Orshark, the budget director, who's a regular on Twitter and has parachuted in on a few Twitter conversations I've had recently, sent me a DM saying, hi Adam, reading crashed halfway through, don't love the way I'm presented, but quite impressed, can we have lunch?
Right.
So there are people who understand... I think they're buying the general story. They don't like necessarily their individual cameo roles in the story. And bloodless it may be, but it's not, I don't think, sparing of some of these people's egos.
Yeah.
I'm not going to pretend that I think that the ECB, Trichet and stuff like that were pursuing a constructive policy. I mean, I would not care necessarily to have an interview with Trichet at this point. I mean, this is, Geithner was the only really significant person I spent a lot of time talking to was Geithner, and I had a long interview with him. The swap lines are interesting because what they do is they get you into the conversation. If you just come along at this point and say, I'm writing a bit about the crisis, they just go, blah, this is so boring, they've done this, they've had their spiel over and over again.
Right.
for years now. And in the case of Guyton, Bernanke and Paulson, they've been in court. So that's they've talked to their lawyers about what story they'll tell about Lehman and AIG, and they're not deviating from that script. Because they were sued by the shareholders of AIG. And so, you know, they swore to a version. So that's rock solid, they'll never deviate, and they won't like the version in crashed.
Yeah.
But if you say to them, I'm really interested in talking about the liquidity swap lines, all of a sudden the lights go off and they go like, that's interesting. Maybe we should talk about that. It's a
that's kind of a secret handshake.
It is, I'm not an expert at all,
but I was struck by having not been fully aware of that story at all.
It is the central, you know, the first two-thirds of the book are really this story of the transatlantic financial connection, how it worked, how it was built, first third of the book, how it exploded in 08 and how it affected the rest of the world and how it was stabilised, and then the long aftermath of that crisis in the Eurozone, because it's the same European banks which are crippled in 08, which are not recapitalised unlike their American counterparts, and therefore limp their way then into the sovereign debt crisis, which is really, in most cases outside Greece, not a sovereign debt crisis at all, but a debt bank crisis. And then across that arc is spanned the story of transatlantic kind of non-diplomacy. None of this is above the board. None of this is loud. This is not New Bretton Woods. This is not, you know, 1940s, 50s style transatlantic diplomacy. It's all at the technical level, backroom talks at G20, central bank to central bank. There's very little politics fundamentally. And yet, in fact, a fundamentally new system is being built to stabilise this deeply networked transatlantic banking system, which isn't bailouts. It's very important to be clear about this distinction. It doesn't involve American Central Bank or the Treasury taking a stake in European banks. Mm. What it involves is them being the other thing that central banks do, which is the lender of last resort to the entire dollar-based banking system, which is really what the central bank, any central bank, has to do, and the Bank of England started doing in the 1850s, which is to provide the promise to banks that in the case of a bank run, if they lose their funding through deposits or something else, that they will be able to swap their long-term investments into immediate cash. Mm-hmm. The idea being that if you can promise to do that on the first day of the panic, the second day of the panic will be less and the third day won't happen at all, because by the third day everyone will go, well, you know what, they do have cash, there's no problem, we can leave our money in the bank. And that's what central banks do nationally and have done since the Victorian period. Like Mary Poppins, there's a great scene of like a bank run unleashed by a little kid saying, I want my, you know, tuppence. And, I want my tuppence. What was astonishing about 08 is A, the scale of the bank run, because it isn't Northern Rock. It isn't what we saw of Northern Rock. It's what really went on behind the scenes at Northern Rock, which is that Northern Rock lost its funding in Australia and New York and everywhere, because Northern Rock was borrowing money from all over the world to enable it to make mortgage investments. And the other thing the Fed then has to do is lend to non-American banks.
Could it have done that in, if that had been in any way out in the open at the time with the political...
Well, they will say you can't ever do lender of last resort out in the open.
Right.
Because of the stigma, right? Yeah. No one wants to be seen to be needing the help.
Yeah.
And if people know they will be seen needing the help, then they won't take it. And that's like a patient not taking the medicine they want until it's too late. And you want everyone to take the medicine really early on. So they will go, you know, that is a key principle of lender of last resort. It should be as anonymous as possible.
Right.
It's also convenient because you don't have to disclose who you're lending to. But the Bank of England and the ECB have never exposed, and it was a Freedom of Information suit in the US brought by Bloomberg, so a mighty news organisation which just sued them all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Fed dropped out of the case, but the clearinghouse, which is the representative American banks, fought it all the way to the end, and the Supreme Court ruled that they should disclose. And so we've got more information about that liquidity lender of last resort action than any other probably in... Well, in modern, you know, in recent history anyway, if you went back to the archives, you could do it for the 50s and 60s, but this is in the 30s and earlier, but it's pretty amazing stuff. Yeah, you can see day by day, like, you know, who got what. And banks like Barclays, which, you know, boasted in the UK of never taking any government support, strictly speaking, it's true they didn't, except they would not have, you know, they wouldn't have gotten past the end of September if they hadn't had the liquidity support.
Right, right. And they got ended up in the wrong direction with the sovereign.
Yes, he ended up taking it from the Gulf. Which is sort of the. But yeah, so no, it's a it's a phenomenal story, and it's long, you know, it's now permanent, it's institutionalised,
yeah.
From the fall of 2013, it was made a permanent set of arrangements, and they're now proliferating around the world, so, you know, Japan has its own swap line network, the Chinese have set one up, there is in fact one between the People's Bank of China and the Bank of England now,
right,
to support the Yuan Renminbi based business that the City of London was developing. So they've become a really kind of general instrument of global underpinning. I analogize it to a little bit to the NSA, which is kind of a spooky and obviously willfully polemical kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's infrastructural. Everyone who's in the know knows about it. Everyone who isn't know is scandalized when they find out about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then everyone in the know goes, you know what, we really need it.
Research.
Like, this is scandalized, but like we don't really have any functional substitute for this, so we'll go on doing it. It's that kind of, and that's a very interesting, I think, category of power that we have now in the world that has this kind of property, which is, we can't live with it, we can't live without it now. You know, we're kind of
a global deep state.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean, you know, there's lots of phenomena, like carbon, the carbon economy is a bit the same. Like, we all know it's going to kill us.
Yeah.
We're kind of, you know, we can kind of imagine how we might escape it, but the wrench it would require to undo it and fundamentally transform it is so massive that no one can really. So we live in this sort of rather unresolved relationship to it, really.
Right. Just going back a couple of ones on some specific sections in the book. There's the debate about whether letting Lehman go bust was you call it an error of misjudgment, and Bernanke says we didn't
have
the power.
They
could have done it then.
Well, I mean, so this is where we will never get resolution, because these guys went to court.
Yeah,
like, you know,
right.
This is their line.
Yeah.
They will sweat. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm not. I mean, I'm just very unpersuaded by it. There's good now forensic work by Berry. This is not an outlandish radical position to take. There's very good forensic work where American lawyers have gone over all of this, and everything suggests that beyond reasonable doubt, Paulson and Bernanke committed themselves. What they committed themselves to was not finding any way to put government money behind the deal.
Hmm.
And they had found ways to put money behind the Bear Stearns deal, and they just simply decided they weren't going to do it in this case. Now, they will tell you they couldn't because Lehman was such a basket case.
Yeah.
And that's where you just go, you're kidding me.
You're kidding me.
They were all basket cases. Bear was a basket case.
Yeah, yeah.
You decided that Bear was dangerous to not put behind. You found some scrappy asset somewhere that you felt you could do the deal on the basis of, and JP Morgan can see some value. So you did the deal.
Yeah.
And the evidence is very clear that the politics dictated they not do it. And this is, for me, a key point, right? And this is why I would say and insist that this is a highly critical account of elite decision making. The Republican Party is disintegrating before the eyes of the Bush administration. Right? They're a minority in Congress anyway. They know they're going to have to rely on the Democrats. The question is, how much are you going to have to rely on the Democrats, and what price are the Democrats going to be willing to pay to do all this dirty work for you, and for the system, right? And over Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, it just became obvious that Berner and the congressional leadership of the Republican Party, was not going to whip their own people into line behind the bailout.
Yeah.
And at that point, in an election year, like, you really do not want to be the administration, you know, because it was still open. Like, it wasn't clear that they were going to lose to Obama.
Yeah, yeah.
And you do not want to be the administration that does this series of deals. And if you talk to like honest people in the Paulson Treasury, they'll tell you they were pleased the day that, you know, Philip Swaggle, his like junior, was saying this was a good day to go to work in the Treasury. We let Lehman fail. This was the right decision.
Yeah,
we should have done this with Bear, probably.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
So at the moment, they're both before, you can see them saying we're not going to add money, and immediately after, like within hours, you can see them say, oh, we did the right thing.
Yeah.
And then 24 hours later, we're powerless, we can do anything about it. And then Geithner comes up with this brilliant, I mean, he's, you know, he comes up with this, we pretended that we had the power because, you know, to say that we didn't have the power would have been, it was better for us to appear vengeful than powerless, and so we appeared vengeful, but in fact we were powerless all along, right? You know,
yeah.
I mean, there may even be an element of truth in that, and it's a complex decision-making process. So Geithner may sincerely think that, but he was the junior link, you know, he was the New York Fed. Bernanke absents himself and just stays in Washington.
Right.
And the missing link, the guy who's really shuttling is Paulson, and all the evidence shows that Paulson is in this moment a political actor. And really just doesn't want to burn the political capital, which is not unreasonable, right? But it just turns, and then they really do think the bankruptcy might not be. You see a lot of them before September 15, saying, you know what, quick, smooth bankruptcy is not a bad thing. We should just give clarity to the markets that they are going. That's the crucial thing. You know, that is really where you have to say huge misjudgment.
Right.